So in today's show, we have Bruce Eckfeldt. He is a strategic business coach and Inc. 500 CEO. And today we're going to talk about growth strategies and creating high-performance executive teams.
If you're ready to learn how technology is driving business innovation in Cincinnati and beyond, you're tuned in to the right podcast. Join us for interviews and discussions with business leaders, innovators, and visionaries. With our host, Sam Schutte, CEO of Unstoppable Software. This is Unstoppable Talk.
Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate you having me on the program.
Absolutely. So maybe a good place to dive in here is, what's your background? How did you get started in your career before you were an entrepreneur?
Yeah, so long story, fairly short. So I started out as an architect. I trained at McGill University, did 2 degrees in architecture. Got into the profession, and while I loved the study and the designing kind of discipline of architecture, I found the kind of professional practice a little slow. Had an opportunity, got recruited to New York to work with interactive media to do 3D modeling. And that kind of got me on a software path. So I did a lot of work on product strategy, product design, really working with companies on this kind of digital transformation they were going through in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then got more tech. So I ended up founding my tech company in 2002, focused on lean, agile software development. So we were, you know, building products for folks. We had a couple of different systems we were kind of developing for companies, both kind of back-end and front-end systems, and then got very involved in agile transformation. So I did a lot of work coaching companies on adopting these kind of lean agile principles and in engineering, but then ultimately in operations and business strategy. And I sold that company a couple of years ago and transitioned to more formally on strategic coaching for growth strategy for these high growth companies.
Hmm. And you're based in?
I'm based in New York City. Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, just because I obviously am in that space of agile development, what were some of the most important strategies you think there that led to your success?
So I think when we were kind of first started, early 2000s, honestly, agile was kind of this crazy idea. I think most companies were, kind of seeing, we were extreme programming. So it was kind of like we were jumping out of planes with parachutes and laptops kind of thinking. And so in the beginning, it was companies that were really kind of pushing the envelope. They wanted something really pretty new and different and innovative. So in those cases, it was, really kind of pushing the envelope, really kind of finding what are the newest tools and newest methods. We were doing a lot of, test-driven development, continuous integration. I mean, these things, a lot of the tools weren't even built at that point. So it was really kind of pushing the envelopes on that stuff. So most of our clients were reasonably cutting edge, and they were bringing us in because we had enough experience we had 6 months more experience than anyone else. So we could actually kind of lead the process and we can kind of help navigate those things. As it developed, it became more of kind of an organizational change work where we'd go in, work with existing software teams, and it was really kind of getting larger teams to kind of adopt these practices. And things became a little bit more standard, but I think always it was about, understanding not just how the systems work and how what it meant to work in a highly iterative, agile manner, but how do we help people make that transition? So really work with them based on where they are at the time and kind of move them through, changing their thinking, changing their process, changing their tools, changing their habits, and really kind of showing them the way and leading it. And it was that kind of guiding capability that we had that I think ultimately made us really successful.
Let's take a quick break. This podcast is sponsored by Unstoppable Software, a Cincinnati-based technology consulting firm. At Unstoppable Software, we bolt on to your company's team and accelerate their ability to deliver custom software development projects. With our deep experience in manufacturing, engineering, and healthcare, we can tailor systems for process improvement, data analytics, machine learning, and document workflow, so they become a user-friendly, perfect fit for your employees and the way they want to work. To learn more about how we make our clients unstoppable, visit us at unstoppablesoftware.com or call us at 513-382-8499. And now, back to Unstoppable Talk.
So as you kind of moved out of that business and started moving into coaching and strategic, coaching and so forth, what was there kind of a first, you know, customer or project that helped you sort of really take off and cement that was the thing you should be doing, or kind of, you know, what was the first big project you did in that sort of new effort?
Yeah. So, I always say that, I founded and ran a technology company, but while I can write code, if I'm writing code, something's gone horribly, horribly wrong, right? Like, mm-hmm. I shouldn't be the one writing code, right? So my focus has always been how to kind of think strategically, whether it's at a product level or a project level or at a company level. And so after I sold the technology company, I got asked to come on, work with a couple of different really friends at the time, had other companies, and they needed either help figuring out strategy, turning around a department, working with their executive team. And I realized that I liked it. That it was really kind of fun going in, kind of assessing a situation, kind of seeing the patterns that were in place. What were the positive patterns? What were the destructive patterns? How to kind of coach them into a new, different way of working. And quite honestly, I was using a lot of the same tools that I had developed, in kind of Lean Agile, just mm-hmm. applying it to a different set. So instead of looking at, how do we create, a software solution, it was really how do we create a process for a leadership team or a management team to execute? How do we set strategic goals? How do we work on those iteratively? Like, I was applying a lot of the same things, and I had used a lot of different tools in my business. I used EOS, the Entrepreneur Operating System. I used some scaling up tools, a lot of Lean Agile tools. And so I knew a lot of these frameworks pretty well. And once I realized that I did enjoy the coaching side of it, I enjoyed going in and working with the executives, working with the leadership to figure these problems out using these tools. At some point, it just kind of triggered for me. It flips any, maybe this is what I need to be doing rather than starting yet another business. I can just focus on that. And I think the really nice thing is that, as I work with lots of different companies, you get to see patterns across different organizations, different industries, you get a perspective and you kind of insights around it. And so really my value now is I can come in and help see, diagnose the situation, sort of see where the major problems are that are affecting growth, bring to bear, cases, bring models, bring kind of patterns that we can use to help them start operating at a higher level, and then work with them on the execution of that.
Gotcha. And so curious if you could sort of define strategy or how you see it, because I think that's a term that, every leader in business everywhere throws around a lot, but then you see how folks implement it or what they actually understand of it. And sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
So how do you define that and how do you teach that?
Yeah, no, it's a good one. I take a very kind of practical approach to strategy, meaning that whatever we do in strategy should help us make decisions on what we're executing on from an operational and task point of view, right? So strategy for strategy's sake isn't very interesting, unless it's going to guide our decision making. In terms of how I approach strategy, the kind of operative phrase that I always use is strategy as an you don't develop strategy to win, you develop strategy to be different, right? So it's not about head-to-head competition. It's about how do you stand out? How do you become unique in your market? And if you look at kind of the history of strategy and kind of the different sort of ways to develop strategy, there's kind of two fundamental ones. One is kind of a high volume, low cost, so kind of the Walmart, right, where you dominate the market, you dominate the supply chain such that you can drive down costs to the point where you can outprice anybody else on a set of commodities. And the other one is being a differentiated strategy, which is you have a unique set of capabilities and a unique value proposition that resonate with a particular set of needs for a particular segment in the market that allows you to command a superior price and superior profit on. And fundamentally, those are the two areas. The low-cost strategy is hard to develop. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of volume. It really only is possible once you are, at the really upper end of the market. So when you look at earlier stage growth companies, the really only viable approach is to take a differentiated strategy. So I'm looking at creating a differentiated strategy, and there's a series of steps we kind of go through, but the end result is identifying a set of needs in a market with a core set of customers or with a set of customers, your ideal customers, focusing on a couple of needs that they have that other people are not delivering on very well, and differentiating yourself against that. Once you have those attributes, those things you're going to be known for. You then look operationally and say, okay, what do we need? What are the specific operational capabilities we need to deliver on those? And that's what you focus on executing on. And obviously, there's a lot of steps in there, and there's a lot of kind of details of how you get it. But ultimately, it's this, how are we going to be different in the market? And then operationally, what do we need to do to make that differentiation true?
Yeah, and that's the tactics part of it. You know, I think folks confuse strategy with tactics sometimes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's there's kind of an, you can have all sorts of discussions on where the differences between those are, and there's various lines you can draw. But yeah, for me, you know, strategy is the position you're going to own in the market, and everything else is then how do you get there? So whether you call it the operational side, I talk about strategy development and strategy execution, right? So the development is what is the position you're going to own, the execution or what are the operational capabilities you're going to put in place. And we break those down. I usually work on a 12-quarter, you know, a 3-year, 12-quarter roadmap. So we're looking at what do we need to do over the next 3 years, what are our forecasts and our key milestones. And that guides our quarterly planning, right? So that's every quarter when we sit down to figure out our 90-day goals, everyone on the leadership team is setting up objectives, things they're doing in the next 90 days to advance strategy against the plan above and beyond their day-to-day functional roles. And that's how we make strategy true. That's how we put the pieces in place, whether it's a system we're going to implement, whether it's a policy we put in place, whether it's a market we're going to open. Those are all things we do on a quarterly basis to make strategy true.
And is there any particular industries where you've sort of worked the most on strategy or, you know, I mean, obviously having that technology background, I'm assuming that a lot of your clients have been in that space, but I mean, have you worked a lot in manufacturing or healthcare as well, or where's sort of some of your focuses there?
Yeah, so certainly technology. So just having a background in technology has gotten me into a lot of tech companies, whether they be, you know, tech startups that are fundamentally technology or just companies that have strong technology components to them, you know, that rely upon technology to deliver their products and services. My background in architecture gets me into a lot of real estate, construction related stuff. So everything from kind of real estate development, property management, financing. We can do a 3-hour episode on low-income housing tax credit syndication. You know, so there's those different domains that is kind of this combination of tech and architecture and kind of real estate that I've done. Having been an architect also kind of gets me into the creative world. So I do some fashion and branding, agency, kind of creative services. And then I picked up a couple of clients in the cannabis space a few years ago. So I do a lot of work in cannabis, which is actually fascinating from a business point of view because of the way, you know, the federal regulations are set up, creates all these interesting market dynamics, and it's combination of, you know, it's one part consumer goods, one part agricultural science, one part healthcare. You know, it's this kind of mashup of several different industries. So yeah. The strategy on that is actually fascinating as you kind of map out strategy because you do have to deal with all these external factors.
Well, and like retail operations and branding and everything, I think ties into that. Those sorts
absolutely
of, you know,
security.
Operations.
I mean, it's literally everything from you know doing you know healthcare. I mean, there's a whole medical side to cannabis, which you know involves the medical healthcare system, which is you know because it's federally illegal, the medical system actually doesn't want to touch it directly. So you have this whole gymnastics that happens when a state sets up a medical program that you have to get a medical card and. Oh, you get an authorized, you have an authorized condition to get the card. And so there's all these kind of, you need to know about healthcare, you need to know about regulations, you need to know about, yeah, retail. Like, how do you set up retail sales? There's a huge, actually, one of the interesting applications of blockchain is in what we call seed to sale tracking because of the regulatory requirements. You need to, every piece of cannabis that gets sold, you need to be able to track back to this, literally the seed that was planted on the farm to know that it's actually been in custody because you don't want to have any, you know, you don't want to have any, a loss of product during the way. So there's a lot of interesting kind of tech that happens in it. And it's really interesting. The agricultural science is fascinating as well.
Is that sort of strategic planning and such, is that different, you think, when you're in an industry like that, that it's pretty much the Wild West, or at least, I mean, nobody really knows like what is the way to succeed because it's too new, you know, versus something like real estate, perhaps that, you know, like, I mean, if you're building apartment buildings in New York City, I mean, there's kind of a way, I mean, are you going to deviate less from some sort of like common ground that everybody's doing? How do you kind of Do you think that's different for those two types of fields?
Yeah, well, it's different in the sense that I would say the underlying principles of strategy are the same. You're still looking for a differentiated position. You're still looking to understand what are the things my best customers care about? What are the attributes that they make buying decisions on? Hmm. How does my competition address those needs? Where are their gaps and opportunities? Where can I own particular attributes that allow me to differentiate myself? And how do I build operational capabilities to deliver on those? All of that is the same. What is different is kind of the underlying attributes is understanding that, well, the things that drive the real estate industry are quite different than, say, the cannabis industry, right? Like you need to know the drivers in that industry. And then the cycle time, it's kind of the industry dynamics can be quite different. So, you know, in cannabis, you know, we're dealing with lots of regulatory changes. You've got a lot of, it's a very frothy kind of industry. So you need to be doing this on a much more regular basis. Whereas, you know, in healthcare or, I mean, if you were in, forestry or something like that, where the cycle time is so long that you're not going to make a whole lot of strategic change, you know, within a quarter, you know, you just don't need to do as much strategic planning or you don't need to do it as frequently. My kind of general rule is your rate of strategic planning or the frequency of strategic planning is going to be a function of the rate of change of the industry. And the more frequently the industry changes or the more dynamic an industry, the more frequently you need to do your strategic planning. The other thing I say is, you know, a strategy is worthless. Strategic planning is what's valuable. So it's the process of planning that is where the value happens. Once you finish the plan, it almost immediately becomes outdated. Right? Yeah. So it's how quickly can you update it? How can you respond? How well do you have those tools set up such that when you do find a change in the market or something dramatic changes in the market, you can quickly pivot or incorporate that into your strategy? That's really where that muscle gets developed.
That makes sense. And I mean, and I think it seems like a lot of the, you know, the other problem in sort of new industries like that would be that you don't know how accurate your assumptions are, right? You know, like it's been in the news a lot here in the Cincinnati area that, you know, there were like two or three hemp processors in Kentucky and they've all gone bankrupt. And effectively, I mean, some of them, you know, are being accused of even stealing the, you know, crops and such of their customers. And there's been all kinds of problems. And, you know, I think it's because they thought, well, I mean, you know, probably you would say they didn't have a very good strategy, right?
Yeah. And certainly strategy, I talk a lot about confidence levels, you know, like so how there's going to be certain underpinnings or certain assumptions you have to make around strategy. And some of those, you're always going to be dealing with uncertainty. And if the question is how confident are you on some of those things? And depending on your confidence, you can be more or less reliant upon it.
Yeah.
And so some of those things, you may have a very low degree of confidence, in which case you need to look at alternative scenarios, right? You need to say, well, this could be anywhere from 20 to 80. So we need to kind of have a plan for each range right now. And then as we start to know more, as we can dial that in, as that cone of uncertainty starts to shrink, we can dial in the strategy. But we need to know what we would do if it's going to be A or if it's going to be B.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, because I know the other thing that's killed that industry or hurt that industry in Kentucky, because I know a lot of folks who are, you know, in Kentucky government trying to promote that as a sort of second tobacco, you know, in Kentucky. And, you know, obviously they all were told by various suppliers the sort of level of THC and whatnot that their stuff would have. And a lot of the crops have ended up too hot, right?
Yeah.
And so they should have maybe said, okay, it's, you know, what happens if it's too hot? What are we going to do? Like, what if it is that B option? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we think it's going to be A because they're telling us it'll be whatever the number is, percent. And so, you know, because they chose sort of the fiber market, I guess, is what we're really going after. They're kind of screwed unless the regulations change. Some of those folks.
So. Yeah. So it's interesting. Yeah. There's multiple levels of uncertainty or different types of uncertainty that I would categorize. I mean, some of this is kind of context uncertainty. So, like in that case, whether a particular, you know, are they going to pass new legislation to allow for certain a different level of THC to happen inside the plants or not? Like that would be kind of an external uncertainty. The actual THC level of your plant, I think it would be more of an operational uncertainty where it's like, hey, look, there's a variable here, right? Like you're dealing with an agricultural product. And, you know, as much as we can choose genetics and we can grow in certain conditions that traditionally have led to a particular THC level in in a cannabis plant to make it hemp, you know, you don't know. Yeah, like there's variability there. And so operationally we need to, you know, have some kind of either wiggle room, like we need to have a buffer there so that we're planning on producing lower and we know that there's statistically it might be a little bit higher, or we're gonna have some testing that happens during the way so we can replant if we're running hot. But yeah, I know a lot of these hemp industries, hemp growers were severely negatively hurt because their final product was outside the limits of hemp, the 0.3% THC limits.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, you talk about sort of your, I guess one way to say it is how frequently you readdress or reassess your strategy can vary perhaps in different industries based on how quickly that industry is changing.
Yeah.
You know, you look at in this time of coronavirus and COVID-19, I've had a lot of good conversations with friends and folks recently about just, you know, people who own restaurants and such, how much that industry all of a sudden, you know, mm-hmm. is completely changed and disrupted. I mean, in a very negative way, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of folks are saying, like, basically, we're, you know, there is no going back, like, at least for the next few years.
Yeah.
You know, if they're going to survive in that space, they need to come up with a new strategy, right?
Yeah.
I'm curious what, you know, if you've worked in that space, what kind of recommendations you might have, or
yeah.
I don't know, what kind of ideas do you have there?
Yeah, I would say the last 6 weeks of my life has been, you know, having these calls with both clients as well as people that have come out of the woodwork looking for help. But look, there's a couple of different layers. I mean, obviously, you know, in a crisis, like a real crisis like this, you know, there's an initial stabilization you need to make. I mean, we were dealing with things. I mean, I had one of my CEOs was in the ICU. I had several members of leadership teams that were hospitalized. So at some level, you need to kind of start with stabilizing the business, figuring out how to get people working from home, you know, getting the new system set up if you're not used to that. You know, but then you really need to start thinking about what does the world look like in 6 to 12 months, and how do I start making some decisions that are going to leave me possibilities then? Because the problem is, or the challenge is, you know, I mean, you can start cutting costs and you can start, you know, right-sizing your expenses, you know, based on not being open or only being open for delivery and things like that. But you know, if you cut the wrong things, or you hobble yourself in the wrong way, you know, when you actually, you know, start looking at a recovery, you know, if we start looking at some kind of opening up in, you know, say 3-6 months, and then over the next 12 months, you know, having, you know, some kind of capability of being able to resume these services, but it's going to be really different unless you've got a pretty good idea, or you've made some educated guesses on what that's going to look like. You may be cutting the wrong things, or you may be cutting things that are actually going to serve you well in that world, and keeping things that may not serve you well. So the work that I've been doing in most cases is developing a model, developing, you know, potentially several models about what the world might look like in 3, 6, 12 months, and then start looking at the business today and saying, okay, what capabilities do we need? What talent do we need? What systems do we need? What resources do we need? And how do we keep those? How do we make smart cuts that are going to allow us either to keep those services or quickly ramp those things back up when we do see an opening up or lessening of these restrictions? And I think that's the big strategic challenge is, A, that yes, companies need to right size, or they need to deal with the immediate crisis that they're in from a cash and an operational point of view. But you kind of need to have some sense of where it's going to be. And yes, at some point you need to look a couple of years out and say, look, does my fundamental business model even still exist? Or is that really where I want to be? Do I need to just look at a new possible business model? And it's hard. I mean, you know, when you're in a crisis, you're kind of looking at everything that's right in front of your nose. It's hard to look out several quarters, potentially several years. But, you know, ultimately, good, solid strategic companies do that. It's much easier if you already have a strategic plan, because you can kind of build off of the plan you have. If you haven't been doing strategic planning, it's hard because you kind of need to create your first plan while you're creating your long-term plan. And it's hard to do that in a crisis, but that is really the work.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, it's hard to know whether you should invest heavily in whatever new approach you think is coming if you're not sure if you're going back to the old way or not. Right.
Yeah.
Like, cause I think, I mean, people are still desperate for entertainment, you know, and that's the thing is, you know, you look at restaurants, bars, all these things. I mean, you know, the product they're selling, of course, is not just food. Mm-hmm. And so if you wanted to say, you know, say like, for instance, here in Cincinnati, we have a lot of local breweries and such. And if you wanted to say, well, you know, we're not going to reopen the tap room anytime in the next 3 years, we're just going to be complete at home delivery. Well, how do you, is that enough? Because I mean, obviously we might have to buy trucks. I mean, is that the right thing to do? Because you're not sure if, well, maybe we will have an open tap room in 30 days, you know?
Well, and I go back to your strategic plan. I mean, if on your strategic plan is a, you know, creating a fun festive atmosphere, mm-hmm. right? If that's one of the ways you differentiate yourself in your market, you know, you need to kind of think through, is that like, how do we do that in the new world? Like, what does that look yeah. like? So some of this is figuring out, well, what is the value we provide? And is there a different operational context or different operational strategy we can use to provide that? So maybe there is a different format. Maybe there's a different kind of physical environment that you can create in this post-COVID-19 world that is going to deliver that, but is going to be operationally different, right? Because we have a new context. Or if your strategy had really been, you know, creating a premium beer of some sort, like you could be more about the product, in which case you look at it and say, you know what, the tap room itself was really more of a function of our ability to connect with customers. It was not the core part of our value delivery. Mm-hmm. Well, then you could make that decision much more easily to say, like, we don't need to worry about the tap room because that wasn't part of our core operational model that delivered on our differentiating values. Right.
So yeah, and you can probably see this all even just reflected in sort of how much companies are being hurt right now. I mean, if you're a small craft bourbon distillery that was really kind of all about people coming in and having events and all this sort of stuff, because all those folks rely on a lot of that mm-hmm. type of revenue, right? Then obviously you're in big trouble. But I bet you, you know, Jack Daniels and those guys right now are I mean, maybe they're not as, I don't know if they're selling as much as they ever did, but they're not hurting near as much, right?
Yeah, no, exactly.
And they might be doing better just because people are buying a ton of Jack Daniels, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The interesting one that I think a really good example of this is the big kind of event space, mm-hmm. you know, the world of conferences and events. Yeah. And I think that's one that we'll see not only is hurt, you know, by the COVID restrictions, right? I mean, obviously these events are not happening, but, you know, most likely they're not going to be happening for a while, right? We're going to have ongoing restrictions, at least, my guess is for 12, 24 months of gatherings of certain sizes and things like that. So, you know, we're not going to be doing these big conferences for a while. And all of a sudden, people are doing all this online stuff, right? People are becoming really mm-hmm. familiar with Zoom, and people are doing these webinars, and they're hosting drinks and all this. So there's kind of these two forces of, one, we're going to have restrictions, and two, people are now educating themselves or becoming more comfortable with a different format. I think that is a really interesting space where, I mean, I've worked with a couple of these companies now in the last couple of weeks where it's like, what is the new model? That is really reinventing themselves. And I have to go back to the core of, well, what do they do, right? I mean, yes, they can connect people in the industry, the trade shows, you know, connect buyers and sellers. There's a certain amount of community building. There's social connection. I mean, they're really kind of going through, like, what is it that we do? And what are the new possible formats that we could create? And it's not just, you know, kind of recreating the trade show online, right? That's not going to cut it. Like, they really mm-hmm. need to think through, what is the value and what are the new operational things that we can do? What's the new business model we could do that could create that value?
Yeah. I mean, and it's you know, it's introducing new forms of competition, right, to these other folks. I mean, you think about, like, you know, if the reason you go out to a bar is because you want to have a fun time and perhaps have, like, cocktails that are, you know, really upscale cocktails. Well, so if somebody invents a service where you can go and have your Zoom meeting, and I mean, you know, I don't even know, maybe this exists already, where you can, you know, get something shipped to you that gives you the tools, the techniques to make these, to make some fancy cocktail, right? Well, if you can do that at home with people all, you know, remotely via video chat, I mean, do you need to go out, right?
Yeah. I know there's someone I was talking to recently, they were talking about some wineries that were doing at-home tastings, right? So they'll ship you, and they could ship, you know, they ship your group, like you put a whole group together, they'll ship everyone the wine, and then they'll do a Zoom call, and they'll have a psalm on, and they'll talk about the wines and everything. So everyone's got their local bottle, everyone's online, they're talking, you've got, you know, an educational experience, right? So they're working on it, right? And there's going to be innovation, right? I mean, you know, we're dealing with, you know, very early kind of evolution of these things. But yeah, I mean, some of these businesses are going to need to completely reinvent, rethink themselves. You know, other businesses, it's going to be like, yeah, I need to figure out a strategy for 12, 24 months, and then the world should more or less go back to normal. You know, but yeah, but it's all about taking the time to think about, like, what the future might hold, What are the forces at play? What are the possible outcomes? What do we need to kind of keep in terms of capabilities? What new capabilities might we need to deliver? You know, how do we make sure that we're, you know, making good strategic choices rather than just, you know, cutting everything? I mean, you need to reduce expense. Well, depending on your industry, some cannabis has been pretty good, but you know, most industries need to cut expenses because they're just not doing the revenue. The economy's not there right now, but you need to do it in a smart way.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, a question a lot of folks are always asking me about this, you know, is how much of this will stick, right? Like you said, when we go back to normal, how much sticks? And it's interesting, you know, if, because clearly two years ago, like no winery anywhere would be really worried about serious competition from some kind of at-home wine tasting company. Like, yeah, whatever. But I mean, if you asked taxi companies the year before Uber came out, if you would get into cars with strangers via some app that you hailed, they'd be like, yeah, we're not worried about that.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is it's like, you know, so even if taxi companies today like halved their fares or their rates, how many people would switch? Because they're used to the technology, they're used to the app and, you know, so on and so forth. People get accustomed to it. And to me, it's not worth picking up the phone and calling for a taxi then versus just, you know, using the app. And I mean, granted, some taxis have apps too, but usually they're not as nice.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, like that stickiness of a solution that people get used to.
Yeah, I think the difference in this case is that in some of those cases, it's kind of evolution of an industry or kind of introduction of new kind of models and technology into an industry from an evolutionary standpoint. In this case, you know, with COVID, it's fascinating because it's this external kind of public health, externally imposed kind of set of changes. And I don't know. My guess is it's not going to be as sticky in the ways that we think it might be sticky. I think we're going to be surprised. I think a lot of things will actually go back to somewhat being the way it was before. I think certain things will be forever changed, and I'm not sure of our ability to exactly see which ones those are going to be. I think there's some things that will be forever changed. I mean, just because once we start doing something in one way. Or once we're kind of worried about this thing now, it will forever change the way we do something. I think other things, you know, people are going to slip back into the old routines once the restrictions are lifted. It's just tough to figure out which ones those are right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, folks who have for a long time been afraid of allowing people to work from home, for instance, you know, once after a few months of this and are like, oh, that's not so bad. Maybe they, you know, allow it to continue. But you know, clearly, like, eating a pizza at home while you talk to your friends on Zoom virtually is a kind of a poor substitute for doing it in person, right? So I mean, I don't think, maybe some people will do that longer term, but most of us will kind of switch back probably.
Yeah, I think, you know, things like that, things like gyms, like I'm really curious about how gyms are going to work, about these kind of shared facilities where we now have this, you know, either PTSD around, you know, potentially being infected or, you know, being in close proximity, you know, where some of that stuff happens, like movie theaters, like, I don't know, like, do people want to go to movie theaters or not? You know, technology is pretty good at home now. Do people just start investing in that? You know, so it will be fascinating. But I think, you know, if you're a business in this space, you know, part of this is, that's why I say that the muscle of strategic planning is what's important because it's not about trying to sit down and guess what's going to happen in 24 months. It's about having the process to keep gathering information, processing that, and updating your assumptions and updating your plan as you get more and more certainty. So, yeah, I mean, if I'm a movie theater chain, I'm probably, you know, putting a couple of different possible outcomes in the future there and figuring out what do we do if this happens? What do we do if that happens? But it's really about how we sit down every month and, well, what more do we know? What else has happened? What data have we connected? What else? Well, how has the context changed? Is there new consumer behavior that we can incorporate? Like, it's that process of gathering and processing information quickly that is going to allow certain companies to ultimately be successful because they're going to outpace, you know, they're going to out iterate on strategy faster than the other companies.
And I guess that also affects sort of like, I mean, because it's one thing for a company to be able to iterate and look at their plan and see change and sort of update. But, you know, that has to kind of go all the way down through their company, that ability to kind of pivot and change quickly, right? Because, you know, it's all well, if I'm a tire manufacturer and I see some big strategic change happening, I mean, that's great that I see it. But if I just spend $100 million on a new assembly line that only does things the old way, so what, right? Like, yeah. I can't change, right?
Yeah.
So how do you, I mean, is that something you see have to help people sort of structure that sort of agility elsewhere in the organization so that they can actually take on those strategic changes?
Yeah, it actually goes both ways. So I talk about information, cascading information up and down the organization. And the sort of, if you look at the kind of the strategic planning process, I always start it with a collection of information, right? So how do we get information from, you know, people on the ground who are interfacing with customers, mm-hmm. with suppliers, with the market? What are they noticing, right? When you sold that last project, when you visited that last customer, when you went to that last supplier site, you know, what did you notice? What was different? What was the same? What were they talking about? What were the concerns? And I want to bubble those up the organization to leadership so they can incorporate that into strategic planning, right? So we're always kind of awareness, developing awareness, looking at what is similar and different in the industry, what trends do we see happening, what new information, what's happening with competitors, all that goes into updating our strategic plan. And then once we process that and turn that into a new an updated set of strategic priorities, like once we set those for the organization, cascading them back down through for implementation, right? And depending on your cycle and how frequently you're doing that, whether you're doing that quarterly or monthly, you know, it's about collecting that up and then pushing it back down in terms of setting the organizational priorities. And I always say strategy, that the key with strategy is you can do anything you want, just not everything you want. And so it's about making a set of choices to align the organization around. And there's different models. I mean, I know I'm a big OKR fan, so I like setting objectives and key results and cascading them down. And yes, I mean, you're looking at how do we change operations? I mean, in the case of the tire manufacturer who's got a product line, you know, it's got a operations and assembly line that's producing something at a certain rate. If that line is pretty fixed, that would make sense if your strategic plan said that this is not likely going to change over the next 12, 24, 36 months. You know, there's lots of great case studies of how companies, new startup companies or smaller companies overtook big monolithic companies because they're more agile. So there's the Nucor mm-hmm. Steel, the mini mill steel yep. model that basically, it started chipping away, right? They went after the low cost
rebar,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And, made that effective at a small agile level. And they just kept iterating and quickly changing what they could do, how they could do it. And they basically were able to change faster than the big behemoth steel mills. And so they outpaced them. Now, you know, that worked because the industry was changing, or they were able to make, you know, capitalize on a dynamic industry. Industries that are pretty staid, you can have more confidence and make your longer term decisions, which is why we kind of don't need to do strategic planning quite as often. But quite honestly, at the moment, what's happening now with COVID is an unfortunate situation of that, where companies have a lot of change coming at them. Ones that are good at changing quickly and processing change quickly are going to fare better than those that have not developed that kind of strategic muscle. So, and it's a trade off, right? I mean, it costs. Cost the organization in terms of resources and money and time to be good at changing quickly, right? So if you don't want to do that every day, it's not going to be a good ROI on developing it to that level. But if right now your strategic planning is only once a year, you're going to get crushed by a company who's really good at doing it once a month right now.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why, whether it be tire manufacturer or any kind of information company, I mean, that's why you see stuff, people moving stuff to the cloud or outsourcing or leasing equipment, anything, I mean, some of these factories you go in, everything's leased. They don't own anything,
Yeah.
Or it's all, I was walking through a brake manufacturing plant recently. And I mean, the actual plant owner is not doing anything of the operations. It's all subcontractors and vendors in there with their stuff that can, not exactly be ripped out easily, but it could, you could bring in a different vendor and have them put their line in, right?
Yep.
And I've heard recently, a lot of companies that I've been dealing with that are going through acquisitions, trying to sell off divisions, they want to be everything to be in the cloud as far as servers and apps and stuff, because they don't want to have to try to split up some data center they own between the companies that they sold the pieces off to, right?
Yep.
I mean, how do you even do that? How do you move the physical boxes and stuff,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, if you're in the business of entering something and then selling it off in a few years, I mean, that's kind of a core strategic decision you have to make, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Generally what I look at is, you know, once we map out the attributes that you want to compete on in the market, you know, how you're going to differentiate yourself, that's going to lead to a pretty clear, concise set of operational capabilities, right? And we call it an activity fit map, and it's a set of differentiators and supporting activities, but it's basically a collection of things that you do that work together in a unique way to deliver on your differentiators. The things within that core set of capabilities, I generally say you want a fair amount of control over. So either you want to own, you want to have exclusive relationships with, you want to have, you know, protected IP around. Everything else, you want to figure out how to deliver as quickly and cheaply as possible, because everything else mm-hmm. is basically a commodity inside your business.
Yeah.
So if it's not in that core set of capabilities, you know, you should be looking for the easiest, cheapest way to deliver on it. The things that are inside are going to be the things that are really are core to your strategic differentiation. So that's the stuff that I would say, you know, focus on really owning and developing IP around and protecting, you know, both from a information and from a control point of view.
So when you bring up developing IP, that kind of segues nicely into a question I was going to ask. We had talked a little about, you know, when you're working with services businesses, how you sort of design them to be sellable or designing those businesses for sale. You know, you mentioned earlier that you had sold your technology services company. You know, a lot of business owners that are service businesses, you know, that's something that they talk about a lot is, well, I can't sell my company. We're just a bunch of consultants. It's not worth anything, you know, or how do we figure out what it's worth? How do you kind of advise businesses to do that? Or what's your approach there?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a challenge. I always say service companies are easy to start, hard to scale, mm-hmm. hard to sell. I think on one hand, there's kind of two things that are going to drive valuation or drive saleability. You know, one is having kind of a clear differentiated strategy, being known for something in a market, right? So if you're a we'll do anything for anybody kind of company, there's really not much strategic value in that, right? Like I can stand up another company that can do anything for anybody. If I am really focused on, hey, we only work, you know, we're experts at this particular situation with this particular software and this particular configuration for these types of industries, I now have a reputation. I've got a known kind of capability in the industry that has some value, right? That is that another company can say, "Hey, look, you know that is something we can leverage in some way." You know, all sales are effectively some kind of discounted cash flow, right? It's some kind of mm-hmm. well, you know, this represents either, you know, something that will be generating cash on its own, or something that we can use to generate cash. We've got a whole bunch of widgets that we can sell to the customers of this company, so we can, you know, we can create sales at a much cheaper level by buying this company than to build our own sales team around it. Right. So in the end, it's going to be some kind of value that you know is created for the company to buy. The other way to do it is, I always say, the more that you can make your service company look like a product company in terms of, you know, having processes, having standard operating procedures, having ways of doing things that are repeatable, that are scalable, that is the other kind of key thing around it. If you look at the contracts, I mean, there's lots of things you can do in terms of moving from kind of one-off contracts to developing reoccurring revenue or longer term contracts, or, you know, if you've got some kind of committed sales or stickiness to what you do, you know, those kind of things are going to increase your valuation. But ultimately, you kind of have to look at it as, well, why would they buy? Like, why would somebody buy you? Like, what is it that they could do with you, either in terms of being able to generate revenue through the services that you provide, or leverage your service in some way to their other clients or their clients to you. So, you know, you have to kind of look through where could you create value on those things. The other thing that always happens in service companies is that if the process of the company, whether it's sales or operations or product development, is reliant upon key people, so whether it's the owner or, you know, parts of the leadership team or, you know, founding partners and things like that, if they are a key to the process, and I say 80% of the time it's around sales, you know, it's just not going to be very valuable, right? Because the moment that person leaves, you know, that company doesn't really run very well on its own, or as a buyer, I would need to figure out how to replace that person. And so one of the first things we do is look at making sure that you've got standard ways of generating sales that don't involve equity holders. Make sure that you've got standard ways of delivering value, delivering your product and service, or delivering on your services that don't involve the equity holders, because you want to figure that those people at some point they're going to sell the company so they can leave. Otherwise, they would hold on to the company. So you need to kind of make sure that you've got processes and procedures around that to make sure that those are going to happen. Then obviously it depends on the business model in terms of what else you need to put in place. But fundamentally, that's how you make it kind of saleable, and that's how you increase the valuation.
I suppose that's, you know, part of some of the risk. If you look at companies, you know, media figures like Gary Vaynerchuk or Tony Robbins and these guys that, I mean, they are their company. I mean, they have, you know, I mean, Vaynerchuk or VaynerMedia, I guess it's called, you know, it's obviously its own big company, but he is so much the face of that. If you're in that kind of coaching space, got to be hard to sort of extract yourself from that and still, you know, not have an acquirer say, no, you're not getting out of this. Like, you are this brand, right?
Yeah.
That's, I mean,
they've done a great job of scaling.
Yeah.
But I would not say that they're super sellable.
Yeah.
Because that asset would be very hard to transfer to somebody else. I mean, like, at some level, you know, like, if the brand abstracts from the person enough, I'm trying to think of a good example, like, you know, you have some big names out there for, you know, Ogilvy and Mather or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Ogilvy is, you know, one of the world's largest advertising agencies, and Ogilvy is no longer around, right? So, mm-hmm. Like, they have done it, but it was not easy. And at that point, it has to be such a scale that you would be able to do it. For mid-sized growth companies, it's not, I don't think it's a real option around it, but, you know, it is possible at a very large scale. But I think that's the difference between scaling a company and making it sellable. You could scale a company and still have these key people. I talk about the rock star strategy, right? You can you can make the owner, the figurehead, a rock star and develop, you know, systems around them. So they just, you know, they go on stage, they do their thing, they leave, and everything else is taken care of. And you can scale a company that way, but it's hard when it comes to selling it.
Gotcha. So when you're talking about engagement structures and such before, you know, I'm curious, how do you structure your engagements with your customers when you're doing coaching with them? Do you do that remotely, or do you have masterminds, or how do people kind of work with you?
Yeah. So the big kind of fork or the decision process is if a CEO has a leadership team in place or not. If they have a leadership team in place, or they're at the point where they really are ready for a leadership team to get put in place, I work with them on getting that team in place, and then I start with essentially a strategic planning process. So we take a couple of days. Sometimes it's a retreat, and we kind of dig into it all at once. Sometimes we spread it over a couple of weeks. But we basically go through, there's about 14, 15 kind of steps to develop your 12-quarter roadmap. But it's really getting into that whole question of, why are you here? What business are you in? Who's your core customer? What do they really care about? How do you want to differentiate yourself, your key operators? What's your three or forecast look like? 12-quarter roadmap. I do a 36-month cash projection. We develop a 3-year plan that really covers strategy and how we're going to execute. And then I work with them quarterly. I usually come in 2 days every quarter, and we go through a quarterly planning process, which is all the, you know, collecting all the data, updating the strategy, coming up with priorities. And then I do a lot of team development to help them figure out how do they level up the leadership team. I always say that the company is only going to grow as fast as the leadership team grows. We need to constantly amping up and leveling up our leadership team capabilities. So that's if they have a leadership team, and we just keep going through that quarterly planning cycle, and I help them get that in place. If there's no leadership team in place yet, I'll either work with the CEO one-on-one, or I do have a couple of mastermind groups where I basically put a group of CEOs together. We work through the quarterly planning process. We do the strategic planning. But I'm really there helping coach them as leaders, getting them working together to kind of share experience so they can grow the business to the point where they're ready for a leadership team to be put in place. And that's really a you know, not only growing the business, but growing the leader. There's a lot of transformation that needs to happen on a CEO to go from, hey, I founded a company to, hey, I've got several hundred people working for me and I'm making, you know, tens of millions of dollars. There are several stages of transformation that needs to happen. And there's the, you know, the coaching phrase that I'm sure everyone here has heard is what got you here won't get you there. Like you need to shed a bunch of things at different points to be able to adopt the new way of thinking. And that's can be hard, right? And that's a lot of what I do as a coach is help with that transition.
Gotcha. Yeah. And those mastermind programs can be so valuable, I think, just to get just the insights you get from other leaders that are in the group that see things that you just are completely blind to.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
And it's just like, wow, I never even thought of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was in one that was sort of more on like the marketing development. That was kind of the topic, you know, marketing and consulting and such and growing your consulting practice. And yeah, just the insights other consultants have that have been doing it much longer than I have.
Yeah.
Was always pretty
well,
amazing.
The different industries, I always find that, you know, I enjoy putting together mastermind groups that are different, either different industries or different facets of an industry. Like I do a cannabis one, which is, you know, there's some cultivators, there's some processors, there's some consultants, there's a retailer, there's product people. And while they're all in cannabis, they see it from such different angles. It's kind of the, you know, the story of the elephant. Like one person touches it, you know, it's the group of blind people touching the elephant, and one person thinks it's a tree, another person thinks it's a, you know, a piece of paper, another person thinks it's a, you know, I can't remember the different ones, but a wall, you know. But it's all because they're touching different parts of it. Well, by getting these people together and sort of everyone kind of benefits from different perspectives and different kind of understandings of how the industry is operating can be really insightful.
Yeah. Very cool. So if we look at some projects you've done recently or just activities you're involved in, what's kind of been the most personally rewarding project that you've worked on recently?
Yeah, so I one of the things I love doing is mentoring earlier stage entrepreneurs. So I do some work here in the city of New York with both minority and women-owned businesses. And you know, the fascinating thing there, I just find that there is so much untapped talent when it comes to entrepreneurs and leaders, just because of, you know, social political situations and, you know, people having, you know, different levels of opportunity. And the thing I love, I've had a couple of these cases now where people that I mentored 4, 5, 6 years ago all of a sudden come back to me, you know, and they were just starting a business. Maybe they had a couple $100,000 in revenue. And they'll come back to me and say, okay, well, we just hit $5 million in revenue. We need your help now. and it's just, it's like, there has been times where I've just like, I kind of, like I even forgot about them kind of thing. Like it just escaped. I've worked with so many of these over the years, but it's such a pleasure to kind of have these things like, oh my God, you did it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, it's fun. I think I realized that one of the reasons I love coaching is I love, you know, just helping people be more successful and ultimately just giving them the confidence or giving them the just the possibility that, oh yeah, I really could have a company this big or I could get to this level. You know, and that's really impactful for me, right? And just ultimately my, you know, my goal is to, you know, create more jobs, create more business to, you know, to fuel the economy by helping create more of these high growth businesses because there's just so much opportunity in these spaces.
Yeah. And it's awesome. And you know, a friend of mine just started a new business and he's, you know, worked his entire career as a salesperson for a lot of different companies. And so he just started a business and I'm just like, oh man, you don't know, you won't even realize what you've been missing out on. Like, cause you know, just getting into that space and the freedom and just the, you know, the ability to steer your own ship and the opportunity. And, you know, I don't think he'll ever, hopefully never regret that or never look back, you know? Yeah. So great. Awesome. So I guess just to wrap up, what are the three main reasons that someone should reach out to you for help? What kind of, you know, what are the three main things that you can help people with?
Yeah. So, I mean, typically people come to me, I mean, one is they feel very stuck, right? They've taken a business to a certain level and they've, they're just not sure what to do next, right? So it could be around strategy. It could be like, we're not really sure how to compete at the next level, or we're kind of struggling to figure out how do we create really a premium situation rather than we're kind of feel stuck in a commodity. That's a typical situation. Another one is where there's conflict on the leadership team, right? So where a CEO has, you know, either a formal or an informal leadership team, and it's just not going well. Maybe there's open conflict. I get involved every once in a while with some conflict resolution where there's, you know, strong, you know, sometimes borderline violent disagreement on a leadership team about things. And so, you know, and a lot of that is really, you know, it's a question of alignment. It's a question on goals. I mean, sometimes there's been some historical things that need to get worked out. But, you know, without a high quality leadership team, it's really tough to grow a business. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And then I do some one-on-one CEO coaching where it's just, you know, CEOs that are kind of trying to figure out how to sharpen their skills and realize that, you know, having an external kind of coach, mentor, observer who can kind of give them some feedback in a constructive but pointed way to help figure out where their next stage of growth needs to happen. Those are typical reasons I get involved.
Great. And what's your contact info if folks want to reach out?
Yeah. So, you can always go to my website. It's ekfeldt.com, ekfeldt.com is kind of my website. And that's got all information about the coaching work I do, has information on the podcasts. And you can always email me at bruce@ekfeldt.com. And I'd be happy to start dialogues there about anyone that's facing any of those challenges or has questions about anything we spoke about today.
Great. Awesome. Well, really appreciate you coming on the show and speaking with me, Bruce. You know, I think this kind of real, you know, in-depth thinking and new thinking around a business can be so valuable for folks who just are used to doing things the old way.
Yeah.
And have never really figured out how to change, how to be more agile. So I certainly hope folks will reach out to you for help if they're in any of those situations. And like I said, yeah, thanks for coming on.
Sam, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Unstoppable Talk. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you did, be sure to support the show by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. And learn more about this show by heading over to unstoppablesoftware.com. Until next time, keep innovating.